Coming up on the program today, our economy, which is good, the North Korean economy, which isn't, and the fracking economy, which is a little bit of both. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 12th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. With an eye toward the Federal Reserve meeting that is happening today and tomorrow, what say we do a quick, where are we now, American economy, as a way to get going, huh? This morning, the Labor Department said inflation, that is prices at the consumer level, are going up at the fastest clip in 6 years. That's mostly gas prices. But even when you talk just core inflation, not counting food and energy, the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, was up 2.2% year on year, which is pretty close to what the Fed has been looking for. Also, a new survey from the National Federation of Independent Businesses shows a whole lot of small business owners are feeling pretty good about the economy and, lo and behold, are raising wages as well. Getting us started today, Marketplace's Aaron Schrenk puts it all into context.
May's inflation numbers are no surprise, says economist Luke Tilley at Wilmington Trust.
We're seeing what you would expect in an economy that has a lot of job growth, some stronger wage growth, and some impacts of tax reform.
Meanwhile, small business optimism hit its highest level since 1983, according to that NFIB survey. 19% of small businesses said they're planning price increases, the most in a decade. Michael Pierce at Capital Economics says that's because of wage pressures that aren't going away. With unemployment below 4%, most economists say serious inflation can't be far behind.
The question now is how far inflation is likely to overshoot the Fed's 2% target.
Some economists have predicted a steep inflation uptick for years now, says Austin Goolsbee at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. But
if you make the same mistake 36 quarters in a row, you should at least be a little circumspect predicting that the 37th time is the charm.
Controlling inflation is a key goal for the Federal Reserve, which meets today and tomorrow. Goolsbee says today's figures will persuade some economists inflation's rising faster than it has in a while. The economy's overheating. Let's hike interest rates fast. But for others,
they're going to tend to look at it and say the growth rate hasn't been as impressive as we wanted it to be. Let's go slower than what we anticipated.
Tomorrow, the Fed could announce the second of four rate hikes expected this year. I'm Aaron Schrenk for Marketplace.
There is no shortage of takes and thoughts and analysis of the Trump-Kim Jong-un summit that wrapped up in the wee small hours of this morning U.S. time. But really for us, this, the president at a post-summit press conference was pretty much everything.
As an example, they have great beaches. You see that whenever they're exploding their cannons into the ocean, right? I said, boy, look at that. Wouldn't that make a great condo behind? And I explained, I said, you know, instead of doing that, you could have the best hotels in the world right there.
So the president dangling economic development as one of the incentives to get Kim Jong-un to give up his nuclear weapons leads us to get Marketplace's Sabri Benishour to look at what we know about the North Korean economy.
If you go to North Korea, there are a few things you're going to notice real quick.
Things are very divided.
Jean Lee is director of the Korea program at the Woodrow Wilson Center.
Foreigners and tourists are treated very well. They stay in very nice hotels where they have electricity and running water. They can only eat at certain restaurants.
She's lived in Pyongyang and has been traveling there for a decade.
They create an illusion of normalcy that foreigners see when they're traveling there.
North Korea hasn't released detailed economic data in decades, but the UN reports that GDP per capita is about $665 US. That's less than Haiti's.
But how their economy actually operates is very different and is kept very much under wraps.
In the real North Korea, the country's currency, the won, is not the only one used. There are Chinese RMB and even U.S. dollars.
The country is very dollarized and there's an active black market.
Steve Henke is a professor at Johns Hopkins University. He says sometime after 2011, Kim Jong-un made the decision to peg his currency to the U.S. dollar. That brought inflation in North Korea down from 926% back in 2010 to just a couple percent today.
The other thing is that he's let the economy kind of spontaneously privatize itself. It kind of looked the other way while the underground private sector has developed.
That may be one of the most defining things about the North Korean economy. The fact there are two of them, the state-run economy, where the state employs people and sends everyone official rations, and the underground economy. This has led to some quirks.
There are two prices for everything. There's the state price, and then there's the market price. And they can vary hugely.
Bill Brown is an adjunct professor at Georgetown. He says wages also vary widely depending on what part of the economy you're in.
A wage of a textile worker in a state-owned enterprise in Pyongyang, there's some big ones, they get paid maybe 3,000 won per month, right? Well, the lady's sister might work in a Chinese-affiliated factory in North Korea, and she can earn 300,000 won. Just a very destabilizing, inefficient system.
The Wilson Center's Gene Lee says Kim Jong-un wants his economy to develop further.
Keeping his people happy will be part of his success.
That, she adds, will depend a great deal on not just what the U.S. does, but also on South Korea, which was not part of the Singapore summit. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Congress, which means some Republicans in the Senate, to be more clear, are trying to reclaim some of the legislative branch's constitutional authority on trade in light of recent events. Reclaim being the operative word there because Congress need only look into the nearest mirror to understand how things got to where they are. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The Constitution gave Congress power over trade. Lawmakers could levy tariffs, and they did, to protect their districts and their political careers. That led to a global trade war in the 1930s. Gary Horlick is a trade lawyer.
There was a huge decline in world trade, which certainly helped increase and lengthen the Depression.
After that, Capitol Hill started ceding some of its trade authority to the White House, thinking the president would act in the best interest of the entire country. In 1934, presidents got the power to levy tariffs to protect U.S. businesses. In 1962, they could levy tariffs in the interest of national security. Around 20 years later, the executive branch got the power to retaliate for unfair trading practices.
Enforce its rights and take actions against other countries for unfair trade practices.
That's Donald Johnson, a former U.S. trade ambassador. He says President Trump is relying on the 1962 law for the steel and aluminum tariffs and on the 1974 law to justify retaliation against China. Congress did put some restrictions on the president, says Sharon O'Halloran, a political economics professor at Columbia.
Disclosure procedures, notification procedures of Congress, many times they have to consult with industry advisory groups.
But if Congress wanted to actually take back its trade authority, it would have to pass legislation, which the president would surely veto. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
A high-stakes summit without a clear upside or downside was fine with Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Pretty sure you've heard me say a time or two on this program that such and such a development in the economy is a business opportunity. That applies to this next item as well, but not without a double take or two. We are marking 10 years since the financial crisis this year and the recession that followed in this economy with a project that we're calling Divided Decade, and more specifically, a first-person series called How We Changed. Today, 30-year-old Brandon Wild in Provo, Utah.
In 2009, I started doing evictions with my dad. He had just got the license and got his business all set up in Las Vegas, and the valley was on fire. In the heyday, my day-to-day life was get up, print, notice of defaults, staple them all together, map it all on Google Maps, make a route for myself, and take off. I would get $18 per eviction. I was doing between 10 a day to sometimes I would even do 20 a day. So it was lucrative. You actually had to knock on the door to see if somebody was home. It was better if you handed to them in person. There were a range of reactions from them. Sometimes people would get belligerent. I did have some dogs sicked on me every once in a while. I don't want to say I was like a vigilante, but there were times when I'd hop fences and run from security, and I guess it was almost like being a teenager again, like a game of hide-and-seek or a game of doorbell ditch. Some people knew it was happening. Other people were blindsided. I did feel bad if I ran into the kids because it was completely out of their control, and I remember growing up, my dad saying the hardest part of his work was taking away people's houses who had kids, because he was a family man. But over time, it just got to be work. You grow accustomed to things, you grow kind of cold, I guess. I do kind of miss it. I did it for years. I only stopped doing it in 2017 because I relocated full-time to Utah. It was almost like having a full-time income on a part-time job basis. I've never thought of the perspective of people whose lives I was stepping into, whose lives I might have disheveled or thrown asunder. This was just a good way for me to not have to work full-time while going to school, and I used this money as a down payment on my own house. You know, it was just business.
We've got some pictures of Brandon Wild on our Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM. And while you're there, let us know how the financial crisis changed you with the hashtag #HowWeChanged. We are getting some really good stories. Coming up.
This was a network of industrial sites. It's some of the most beautiful country I have ever seen.
Fracking and economic non sequiturs. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials barely budged today, dipping just a point, 25,320, not even worth it percentage-wise. NASDAQ added a half percent, 43.7703. S&P 500 gained a tenth percent, that is 4.2786. After the summit, defense stocks might need to start playing some offense. I think Northrop Grumman sheared off 1.5%. Lockheed Martin lost 1.2%. Raytheon down nearly 3% today. Boeing got away with less than a tenth percent of a drop. A bit of after-hours trading now, huh? I'll tell you what the numbers are, you think about why. AT&T, after the bell, up and down and up and down and down. At the moment, Time Warner soared nearly 5% after hours. How come? Come on, you know. Financial firms had a down day. J.P. Morgan Chase gave back a half percent. Goldman Sachs moved down about 0.6%. Bond prices, they fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
I'm Shepard from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I listen to Marketplace several times, actually every day, because it's got the economic news and developments that are important to me. I donate to Marketplace so that it can be available to everyone, and I hope you'll join me in this effort. Thanks.
To join Shepard as a Marketplace investor, donate online at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back in October of 2016, then-candidate Donald Trump, on the day that the AT&T Time Warner $85 billion merger plan was announced, said this.
AT&T is buying Time Warner and thus CNN, a deal we will not approve in my administration because it's too much concentration of power in the hands of too few.
The Justice Department did fight it, but today a federal judge decided very much the opposite of what the president wanted. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is on the story and on the phone from New York. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Kai.
So this was about as clean a win as AT&T was going to get. What else do we know about the ruling from Judge Leon in this case?
Yeah, so what's really notable about this decision is that the judge is allowing this decision to go ahead without any conditions on the deal. So if we just back up for a minute, most people, you know, think of AT&T as a cell provider. In this case, we're actually really thinking of it as a distribution company through its wireless networks and its satellite television company, DirecTV. The question here was whether buying Time Warner and the content it produces would harm competition. And the judge said pretty firmly, no, the deal can go ahead as is. It doesn't have to, the combined company won't have to sell off any pieces. That was one possibility the judge could have opted for if he thought the combined companies would be too powerful in order to protect consumers. He could have said, you know, the deal can only go through if the merged company sold off, you know, some distribution assets from DirecTV or some content assets from Time Warner. So that's a pretty big win for AT&T. And then another notable thing, the judge, it was just very clear that the government didn't meet its burden of proof that this would lessen competition.
So what then does the larger corporate America community take from this ruling? Because everybody was watching.
Yeah, lots of people watching, in part because of the politics of the case that you mentioned with that clip from Donald Trump, President Trump.
Yeah.
But also because this is a pretty unusual antitrust case. It's just, it's not your typical case where you have two competitors merging. It's what's called a vertical merger. So the companies here, they don't do the same thing. They're at different stages of the process. One makes content, one distributes it. And historically, it's been less common for the government to challenge these types of mergers, mm-hmm. but they still have. There are similar deals potentially pending in the media world. Comcast may now try and buy 20th Century Fox. Disney might want in on that, too. So those deals obviously looking more appealing now. But also in other industries, like the proposed Aetna and CVS yep. merger, that's looking like a green light, too.
There is, of course, the right of appeal in the American judicial system. The judge had some words, though, for the government.
Yeah, the government can appeal this decision. It can also ask for an injunction, which would put the deal on hold while the case is appealed. And the idea here is, you know, that if the companies go ahead and merge, it's pretty hard to undo that later if the appeals court were to agree with the government and overturn this decision. So a notable thing about this decision is that the judge was very firm in his wording that the government should not seek that injunction. And we'll obviously have to wait and see how they react to that.
The government can sue afterward, though, right, to try to break it up once the deal is done. I mean, they can do that. So
Yeah. It's just it's obviously much harder to undo something that's right. been.
And also just to, just to point out here, Tracy, before I let you go, David McAtee, I'm reading the wires here now. The general counsel for AT&T expects this deal to close on or before June 20th, which is like so quick. This thing is going to just happen.
Right. June 20th is the expiration right. for this deal. So Time Warner would either have to agree to, if the deal didn't close by then, Time Warner would have to agree to extend the deal. So they're going to try and wrap this up as fast as possible.
Tracy Samuelson in New York for us on this huge corporate merger story. Tracy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
On a related thing, actually, because it is all kind of related, I talked to Federal Communications Commission Chairman Ajit Pai yesterday about competition in the internet space, which is at least in part what this deal was all about. We have it, that interview, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, online marketplace.org. Fracking, or hydraulic fracturing more properly, is not a new story in this economy anymore. Pumping pressurized liquids, water and sand and a bunch of chemicals down into rock to free up the natural gas and petroleum is well established. And it is still controversial decades on. It's also, for the parts of the country where the geology lends itself to be fracked, a welcome source of income. Among those parts of the country are two towns in southwestern Pennsylvania called Amity and Prosperity, which is also, as it happens, the title of Eliza Griswold's new book about fracking and what it has meant for the lives of some of those people in those towns. Eliza Griswold, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Before we actually get into the substance of this book, I want you to tell me, and this is going to sound weird, but I want you to tell me about Cummins the puppy.
So Cummins the puppy belonged to Beth and John Voiles, and Beth Voiles, she thinks Cummins drank from a puddle of water that was contaminated by waste, industrial waste, and that's what made him sick, and eventually Cummins died.
So now that we have Cummins, the puppy, I want you to tell me about Stacey Haney.
So Stacey Haney is a single mom, and she has for many years been a nurse, and she has a small farm. She had a small farm,
yeah.
And she was living there pretty happily until 2010.
You say she was happy until 2010 because in 2009, if I have my dates right, she signed a fracking lease.
Yeah. So Stacey Haney, she was very, very proud to sign a lease when oil and gas came about a decade, a little more than a decade ago, to her area. First of all, she wanted to buy her dream barn, a barn that was going to cost about $9,000. But she was also proud to support America because she believed that American energy independence would help keep American soldiers out of foreign entanglements that involved oil. And she saw exploiting the energy that was on her land as part of an American solution.
I want to point out here that this is a story, in part anyway, of the terrible things that happened to Stacey Haney's family. Contaminated water is the least of them. The child gets horribly sick. The livestock, I mean, terrible, terrible things happen after she signs with Range Resources, the fracking company. But at the time she signed it, it was a good idea for her.
It was a good idea. You know, she is a pretty tough customer. She's very smart. And for all she could see and hear, this was the right thing to do.
You reported this story over like 7 years or something, right?
Yep.
Yeah. you got there sort of 2 years after she had signed the lease and after the fracking started. When you got there, what did it look like, smell like? Was there grimy dust in the air? I mean, what was it like?
You know, what struck me most was just that this was a network of industrial sites. It's some of the most beautiful country I have ever seen, and I have been all over the world. And the frac sites can be hard to see. They're often at the top of hills, which can make their water contamination even more of a concern, because anything at that top of the hill is going to run down. But all of the industry surrounding, truck traffic, waiting, getting stuck at, you know, behind water trucks that traveled at that point in caravans, really for safety, because that it was better for them. It was just, go ahead.
Sorry, there's a great scene. It's not a scene. It's like a sentence and a half in this book, talking about those water caravan trucks. And the first one goes through like a yellow light, and then the other, you know, 10, 12, 14, whatever it is, keep on a going. And so if you're driving through Amity because of these trucks, you get stuck.
Exactly. And that's the least of it. So one of the things that the book really tries to chronicle incredibly carefully and fairly are the hidden costs associated with industry. You know, in some places, people love the oil and gas company that has come through and paved their roads. Mm-hmm. But how long does that paved road last? And what are the longer term costs that Americans end up paying?
There are, we have to say, people in Amity and Prosperity and in the surrounding townships who were okay with the fracking company, Range Resources, and didn't actually have a problem with it.
More than okay. You know, one of the first times I went to Amity, I went to meet a farmer, but he also, you know, what he did day to day is he's a barber. So this one barber said to me, you know, where are you from? And I said, I live in New York City, but I'm from Philadelphia. And he said, that's two strikes against you. Right? And that conversation began for me a learning, which was why over so long have rural Americans felt increasingly disenfranchised and really enraged at urban Americans. And part of that has to do with people who are supportive of fracking, legitimately so, saying, listen, you guys are going to come in here and wag your fingers at us? This is the first opportunity we've had to make money off of our land in more than a century.
I don't usually do this, but I want to go on the way out here. I want to go to the note on sources that you include in the back of this book, and I want to go to the very end. And the last two sentences of this book are, this is the story of those Americans who've wrestled with the price their communities have long paid so the rest of us can plug in our phones. Some feel that price was worth paying. Others don't.
You want me to say anything?
I don't know. What do you say?
I mean, what I hope this book does is fairly portray a place and a people who have been screwed by disparate interests for a very long time. And sometimes those voices can be hard to listen to, but that doesn't mean that we don't have to do it.
I'll tell you what, it's actually a hard story to read. It's a book called Amity and which doesn't mean you shouldn't read it, by the way. It's called Amity.
Yes.
Yeah, please read this book. Amity and Prosperity is the title, One Family and the Fracturing of America by Eliza Griswold. Eliza, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Kai, thank you so much.
Range Resources, by the way, the company that Eliza talks about in her book, is still in business in Pennsylvania and some other parts of the country. We've got a link to the first two chapters of Amity and Prosperity online at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, kind of a mix of corporate public service and corporate profits, I guess. Netflix announced today that Anthony Bourdain's travel series Parts Unknown, originally scheduled to leave Netflix this coming Saturday, is going to stay on the platform, quote, for a few months to come, end of quote. All right, we're out of here. Dow Industrial is basically flat today. NASDAQ up 0.5%, 43 points. S&P 500 up 0.1%. That is 4 points there. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.